Hi, folks. My name is Chris, and I'm the artist and co-founder at Explorer Maps.
Hi, this is Vanessa, Chris's wife. I have been a number one fan of Chris's art since I first met him in the late 1990s. Which map will you get to help you treasure your own special times? Please be sure to use the promo code Mandela for a discount when you visit exploremaps.com.
Welcome to The Trail Less Traveled, an adventure radio series and podcast dedicated to collecting stories and sounds from around the world in order to take you back to mankind's earliest form of entertainment, storytelling. This episode was recorded on location in collaboration with Explorer Maps. Missoula, Montana is a mecca for outdoor enthusiasts, and each week we will bring you tales of adventure from both near and far, as well as information and inspiration and a few tunes to set the mood. You can subscribe to the podcast and learn about our international outreach projects at traillesstraveled.net. And now, here's your host, international expedition guide, conservationist, and yogi, Mandela.
Today, The Trail Less Traveled is being recorded in Missoula. We are sitting in the home of Briony Schwann. Briony is a lifetime social change activist, nature lover, photographer, who is deeply curious about life and the nature of consciousness. Briony was born in Zimbabwe and moved to Montana in 1986. She began running Whitewater in the late 80s. She founded Women's Voices for the Earth in 1995, and she co-founded the Biomimicry Institute in 2006. I met Briony at Lewis and Clark Trail Adventures while we were rigging for a Maine salmon expedition. And that was over 15 years ago, I think, when I was 19 years old. And we were running all women's trips on the Maine salmon for a number of years.
Yes.
And I'll never forget you setting up safety in your cat boat on the Maine salmon and just all the times that we had on the water together, and just so grateful for that. And you've also changed my life because you helped me to find myself in this new career that I'm in with wildlife conservation. So I have many reasons to honor you for your friendship and your guidance. Thank you.
Thanks, Mandela. It's so great to sit here at my kitchen table with you.
My first question for you is, where did you grow up and how was adventure a part of your childhood?
So I was born in Harare, Zimbabwe, which at that time was called Salisbury, Rhodesia, before the country gained independence in 1980. My father was from Namibia, grew up in Namibia, and my mother was South African. My actual family goes back to the late 1700s in Africa. It's a very mixed bag. My father came from Irish and German and Dutch stock, and my mother from French and English background. But my father's family were part of the Dutch settlers who settled in South Africa when it was the Dutch East India Company was traveling through there. So yeah, family goes way back. For the good and the bad, and there's plenty of bad. But my parents both moved to Rhodesia, it was called Rhodesia then, when they were in their 20s, because they were pretty disgusted with the politics in South Africa and apartheid. Mm-hmm. And they really didn't like what was going on, and they were kind of looking for a new life. And they moved independently of one another. They met each other up there. My father was a school teacher. He was a really interesting man. He was a school teacher, and it was during the summer when he was early in his teaching career, and his friend Alex Berry was the director of Unilever in Rhodesia. And he called my dad up and said, "Hey, I just lost a manager. I really need help. Can you come up?" And my dad wanted to go up there anyway. So he went up to help and work for Unilever, but being a teacher at heart and having education at heart, he got very interested in education, and particularly education for Black students, because there really wasn't much post-high school education. And so he got a bunch of teachers together and local, African teachers, and started creating curriculum in the native languages of the area, Shonan and Bali. And so he started creating curriculum and bought an old printing machine and put it in his two-room apartment. And that led to the development of an educational publishing company. And also, he was the founder of Central African Correspondence College. It was the first correspondence college for Black students. There really wasn't much post-high school educational opportunities for Black students, and he wanted to change that. And so that's sort of how he got started. And then my mom moved up there, and she was an artist. And she met my dad on a blind date, and they got married and had me. And then she ended up working for his publishing company, doing illustrations for educational books. And adventure was a big part of our family in a very different way than people think about it here. You know, we didn't have REIs or trailheads and shops with all these kinds of gear. You know, it was pretty rough and ready back then. But my dad loved to be in the bush. Well, both my parents loved to be in the bush, but my dad especially. So he would take us kids out into the bush whenever possible. And in Zimbabwe, there were a couple of places, the eastern part of the country. And of course, when we were very young, it was before the war started. The war started, I should have looked up the date, but it was a gradual start. So I don't think there was any specific date that the Civil War started. But we would go into the bush, and there were a couple of places, the Eastern Highlands of Zimbabwe. There are some mountains that run along the eastern border where Zimbabwe borders Mozambique. And so we would go in there, and my dad found this little very primitive cabin on a river there. And we would go there many times as a family and hike up the river and swim in the river and just play and explore in all the streams. And, you know, we had a pretty wild childhood in the sense that my parents would just like, let us go out into wild areas and not really worry too much about us. Mm-hmm. And then we spent a lot of time in Hoangi. It was called Wanki National Park then, but it's now called Hoangi National Park, which is the largest game reserve in Zimbabwe. And I have many great memories from that. One of my favorite stories is my dad, one time we were driving to Hoangi, and there was this place called the Gwai River Hotel. And my dad had booked a couple of nights there on our way out of the game reserve. And it was literally like a typical African shack. It was little stucco walls and a corrugated roof, iron roof for the hotel. And we stopped, and the swimming pool looked more like a pond. It was like pea green, full of algae. And we were kind of grossed out as kids. We were like, oh, why do we have to stay here? But we were intrigued because they had two zebras that were tame and that you could ride. And so we were super excited about coming back and riding these zebras. And anyway, we got back, and it was so hot the day we arrived that we just didn't care about the slimy green pool, and we just like jumped in. And then we got to ride the zebras, which we thought was the coolest thing. But the funniest part was in the dining room, they had this ancient cooling fan system on the roof that was basically a series of planks that were perpendicular to the ceiling with a big rope through it. And the rope would move and make these panels just sway from side to side and create a breeze. And of course, there was some poor African kid outside who'd been paid, probably, you know, 25 cents to stand there and pull this rope up and down. Anyway, we were intrigued as kids, and there were a whole bunch of other kids there. So we all ran outside, and we were taking turns pulling this rope when the adults were eating. But it was not supposed to be pulled with such vigor. And so we were just pulling this rope, and the thing was slapping against the ceiling and dropping dust and cobwebs down on all the adults. Needless to say, we were no longer welcome at that hotel again after that. But anyway, that was just a fun experience. A couple of other places we spent a lot of time was Victoria Falls, which is on the Zambezi River. And these are the widest falls in the world. They're a mile wide. They're absolutely magnificent. And one of my favorite memories there is my parents had rented a little cottage that was right along the Zambezi River. And we were staying in that cottage, and we came home one night, And my dad had to drive off the road and come around the side of this cottage. And we pulled around the side to the front door, and there was this massive bull elephant. And it was eating marulas, which are those fruit that ferments, and the elephants actually get drunk on it. Elephants and monkeys and all kinds of animals will get drunk on it. And there were a whole bunch of marula trees there. And this elephant had been feeding on these marulas for a while. So it was kind of tipsy and pissed off. And I remember my dad almost breaking the gears in the car, trying to reverse backwards to get away from this big, massive bull elephant. So we go back to where the game headquarters were, and we asked, like, what do? We can't get into our cottage because this elephant's there. And the guy said, well, just go back and try to bang the side of the truck. Don't get too close, but bang, and maybe the elephant will go away. And anyway, we tried that. It didn't work. And so we had to go back into town for a few hours and eventually got back. But what we found out was that the elephants, this particular herd of elephants, would cross the Zambezi River and go out to this island and feed there during the day. And then they would come back across the river, and their path was always past this particular cottage. And so the next night, my dad said, okay, we're going to really have a great elephant experience. So we sat on the porch of this cottage, and we had to turn all the lights off, and you could barely breathe because my dad would be like, shh, shh. And we sat there, and this herd of elephants came by that evening, and they were so close, you could have stood up and touched them. And we just sat there just absolutely still and just in awe of these amazing, you know, they were so quiet, but they were so giant, and you could just feel their magnificence. So, you know, I grew up having so many experiences like that. We used to go to Mozambique a lot for summer holidays, and it was always a big expedition to drive there. In the early days, when my dad first went there, you know, it wasn't even a fully tarred road or asphalt road. It used to have these two strips for your tires, and you'd drive on that road, and then when an oncoming car would come, you'd have to like pull over onto the dirt and let the other car go by. So it was pretty wild and undeveloped at that time. But we used to go to Beira in Mozambique and have a lot of summer holidays there. And I remember one time going to Gorongosa Game Reserve, and I remember as a kid that we took this ferry across, which is not quite like ferries that other people think about. It was literally a bunch of those big steel drums that were strapped together with pieces of wood across the top of them. Mm-hmm. And you would drive your car onto this ferry. And there were a couple of guys with big sticks that would push the sticks into the river bottom and like push you across the river. And I just thought, I was in awe of this experience, but I was also kind of terrified because I couldn't figure out why this raft was not going to just all of a sudden let loose and we'd go floating down the river in a car with no paddles or anything. But anyway, it made it across. But we just grew up with fantastic experiences. And I remember Gorongosa especially because we saw so many lions and just, you know, parked right there next to this massive pride of lions and just watching they come all around the car. And then when I was in college, because I went to university in South Africa, and then I would come home for summer holidays, and I had a summer job at the Victoria Falls Hotel, which is where my first love for marimba bands came, because there was a marimba band that used to play at the Vic Falls Hotel. I remember one time where the staff were sitting out on the deck in the evening and having drinks after work, and one of the housekeeping staff came and said, you know, we need help. There's a guest that has a cobra in their room. And there was some poor guest that had gone for a nap and woke up, and there was a cobra on the sort of table by the window, and they were just too terrified to move. Well, there were a bunch of army guys having drinks on the porch. So we went over to them and said, how would you guys like free drinks for the night if you could go in and get rid of this cobra? And so this bunch of army guys goes into this room with a bunch of pillows and who knows what else. And I don't know how, but they managed to extricate that snake out of that room. You know, I mean, snakes are we grew up with snakes. I've got so many snake stories of close encounters with some pretty dangerous snakes. And then also the other place where we spent a lot of time as kids was my parents had a boat on Lake Kariba, which was one of the longest and widest. It's a really big lake, much bigger than Flathead Lake, on the Zambezi River. And it was dammed to provide power for Zimbabwe and other southern African countries. We had a boat there, and that was such a magical experience because we would go to really remote parts of the lake and we'd go fishing. And I remember my parents used to just bring like a bag of lemons and butter, mm-hmm. and we used to catch bream, which was this wonderful buttery fish. You could always guarantee you would catch so many bream, so we didn't have to bring in much other food for dinner. But one time we were on the lake, and I won't go into the whole story because it would take a full hour, but we ended up getting stranded up there and attacked by a swarm of bees, Africa bees. And it literally is a story of running away from the boat because the bees came onto the boat and we were all in our bathing suits, mm-hmm. and having to run through the bush away from these bees when there was elephants and crocodiles and you name it, and then sitting stranded on the lake shore in the dark for a night in our bathing suits with nothing to protect us. And, Montana, you have to worry about grizzly bears and mountain lions, but there, as you know, way more predators there than just those two. So that was a pretty terrifying experience, but, all part of growing up in Africa. Mm. That part of the adventure continued for a while. Even after I left, I went back with my partner from here in 1999, and we bought an old truck and we fitted it out with a bed in the back and got a bunch of camping gear. And we drove all throughout South Africa, up into Namibia, up through the deserts of Namibia, and then through the Caprivi Strip, which is this narrow piece of land between Angola and Botswana. It's a little bit of Namibia that runs between those two countries. And it was still active with warfare that was happening at that time, so it was pretty hairy to drive through there. And I should say, that was another big part of my childhood. It wasn't something that I chose to have happen, but, Zimbabwe experienced a civil war. So for a lot of the time of being out and adventurous in the bush, we also had to deal with the fact that many times things were not safe because of the civil war, and a lot of the fighting that was happening was out in the bush. And so a lot of times in my early teens, our adventuring was curtailed by war, and we had to worry about things like landmines and being ambushed. But that's a whole different kind of adventure. But anyway, when we did this trip in 1999, 2000, we went through the Caprivi Strip and then into Botswana and the Okavango Delta, mm-hmm. and camped in places, in the most remote places. And there were some roads that we took, you could barely call them roads. And my job was to get out and wade, because some of these dips in the road would be filled with massive puddles that looked like swimming pools, and I'd have to walk through and see whether they were shallow enough to actually get our truck through. And there were times when I just said, boy, if we break down here, maybe they'll find our skeletal remains 5 or 10 years from now, because there was nobody out there. But anyway, we went back through that area, through the Chobe Game Reserve, the Okavango Delta, and then into Zimbabwe, and all throughout Zimbabwe, and then back down to South Africa. So that was an amazing, amazing trip. And, I continue to go back whenever I can, because you never will get Africa out of your body. It's, being born there and growing up there, it's with you always. And I never feel more at home as I am in the African bush.
Brian, I'd like to talk to you about that shift in your life, moving to Montana in 1986, and the adventure of being a young woman from Southern Africa, finding the beauty of the mountains here in Montana and navigating this jungle.
Okay. Yeah, well, it wasn't a straight road to get here. After I did my undergrad degree in South Africa, I moved to England and I lived in London for a couple of years, and then moved to the States, and I lived in Connecticut for 4 years. I worked for Yale University, and then I ended up moving to Montana. And at first, I really didn't know that much about Montana, and I was a little bit nervous. I thought it was like moving to Siberia, but I totally fell in love with Montana when I moved here. And very quickly, I met some people that were into canoeing and into whitewater canoeing. And so I started to learn how to canoe, and I learned on the Bitterroot River. You know, it's not a whitewater river, but it's a dangerous river. Actually, more people drown on the Bitterroot than a lot of whitewater rivers because it has a lot of strainers in it. And I did some great training with Alan Bergmuller, who is a fantastic canoe instructor, and I learned a lot with him. And we would do some adventurous rivers together with a whole group. A whole group of us would do some rivers together. And then after that, I decided, well, I should learn how to kayak. And so I did some kayaking lessons with John Anderson from the Trailhead. And I liked kayaking, and I kayaked the gorge a few times, but I didn't particularly love being squashed into a little boat. It made me really nervous that when you flip, you know, if you don't get your roll down, and you'd have to exit from your kayak. And I also just found it not super comfortable for long periods of time, and I love to be on rivers for multiple days.
Yeah.
So I happened to go on an outfitted trip. I was working for the Craighead Wildlife Wildlands Institute. They decided to do a board meeting on the Lower Salmon River, and it was outfitted. And the guide that was in the boat that I was in, when he found out that I canoed and kayaked, he was like, well, do you want to row the boat? And I was like, sure. And I loved it so much, I just like, that's it, I'm getting my guide license. So I immediately tried to figure out how to get my guide license and started learning with Lewis and Clark Trail Adventures. And then did most of my training on the Lachsaw River. Mm-hmm. I have been running rivers ever since. I guided for about 23 years, very part-time, because I always had full-time work doing conservation environmental work. But I always figured, hey, if somebody wants to pay me to do what I love the most, which is, you know, being on a river, I'm all for it. And so that's where you and I met, was guiding women's trips on the Maine Salmon. Mm-hmm. And I feel really lucky to have been on many, many rivers, wild rivers, from the Salmon, the Lachsaw, the Selway. Did a trip up in Alaska in the Tatanchini River for 12 days. That was incredible. Never saw another human being after day one. And just talk about a wild landscape. And then, yeah, that one was like floating through icebergs. That was the wildest thing. And then I've done the Grand Canyon a couple of times. You know, I always say, so many rivers, so little time. Mm-hmm. So it's really my big love. But, you know, I never wanted to do it full time because I got really active as an environmental activist right after I moved to Montana. I was sort of dismayed by the logging practices that were happening here and seeing beautiful places just decimated. So I first got involved with Friends of the Bitterroot, and then I ended up getting involved with the Alliance for Wild Rockies, doing a lot of conservation work, got a job with the Craighead Wildlife Wildlands Institute, which doesn't exist anymore, but it did back then. John Craighead was a very well-known bear biologist, very famous bear biologist in Yellowstone. What was a pivotal moment for me was realizing that the conservation movement was almost entirely run by men and white men. I really felt that the movement was missing critical voices. And it's a whole thing that I could talk about for hours. I had gone back to school to do my master's in environmental studies, and I started talking to my professors about how I felt that the lack of diversity in the environmental movement was impacting its effectiveness. And the university gave me a small grant to put on a women's environmental conference, which we did, which is called Gender Justice and the Environment. And it was such a powerful conference, and so many women from around the Pacific Northwest came for that conference and told stories about how they felt like they had been excluded from the movement or their voices weren't heard. And so that was the nemesis for starting Women's Voices for the Earth. And so fortunately, I was young and naive, and I quit my job and said, well, I'm going to start this organization, and put together an amazing steering committee of incredible kick-ass women. And we started WEAVE. That was the acronym, WEAVE. We started WEAVE in 1995, but still doing amazing work nationally around women's health and the environment. I stayed with WEAVE for about 12 years. And we ended up focusing a lot of our work less on conservation and more on toxic chemicals. Mm. So I worked on chemical policy for all those years and ran some super fun campaigns. A group of other women and I started a campaign called the Campaign for Safe Cosmetics, where we went after the whole health and beauty industry, because essentially many of the products that you're using are just bottles of chemicals, and many of them are linked to cancer and endocrine disruption and birth defects and so forth. So we ran an amazing campaign for about 5 years nationally, where we really changed the whole health and beauty industry. But it was depressing to work on, because it was always one step forward and five steps backwards. And, you know, a lot of people don't want to hear it. It's bad news, and they don't want to hear about how our lifestyle is actually poisoning our own bodies and our breast milk and the planet. And, you know, I got really burned out from working too much and just from the depressing subject matter. And my friend Janine Benyus, who had written the book Biomimicry: Innovation Inspired by Nature, had been talking to me for a while about trying to get a biomimicry institute started. And because I was burned out at first, and she was talking to me about helping her get it started, I was like, forget it, Janine, I'm not going to start another nonprofit. But then she was speaking at the Bioneers conference, and I was sitting in the audience, not with anybody I knew. I was surrounded by strangers. And she's an incredibly inspiring speaker. And people were so moved by the concept of biomimicry that they were moved to tears, literally. And so I thought, wow, you know, maybe this is the hopeful space. And so for people who don't know what biomimicry is, it's innovation inspired by nature. If you think about the fact that, you know, planes have been designed based on flight that's been studied from birds. People are now designing wind turbines that mimic the tail of humpback whales, mimicking nature's chemistry by looking at how blue mussels create an adhesive, a waterproof adhesive, underwater and seawater that is non-toxic, because they can't afford to poison their own bodies. Mm-hmm. And so Columbia Forest Products mimicked the glue that the blue mussel makes to make a non-toxic wood composite. It's mimicking nature's shape and form to be more efficient, energy efficient. It's mimicking nature's chemistry. Nature does all its chemistry in water. We do all our chemistry in oil with a lot of really highly toxic chemicals. Nature's chemistry is sophisticated and elegant, but all based on water. And then it's mimicking nature's systems, looking at how trees talk to each other under the ground, how they send chemical signals, how do plants and animals become interdependent on one another, and how there's no such thing as waste in nature. Waste for one organism is a feedstock for another organism. And these systems are complex and beautiful and self-sustaining, because life creates conditions conducive to life. And so I finally said to Janine, okay, I'll do this. I'll do this for 2 years. I'll help you get the institute up and off the ground. And I ended up staying for 8 years. And it was a really incredible experience, because we built an institute that was an international institute. And our goal was to get schools and universities all over the world to incorporate biomimicry in the design programs, whether it was engineering, chemistry, material science, architecture. How do we embed nature's brilliance in those programs? And so it was fantastic. I got to travel all over the world, because we had biomimicry groups established on almost every continent. And then after 8 years, I was burned out again. And so I left, and since then I've been working on my own. And this journey has been where I've gone into this journey of the nature of consciousness and asking the deeper questions about why are we here on this planet? What are we supposed to do in this marvelous short lifetime we have? And that has taken me to doing a lot of inner work, to ask much deeper questions like, what's the meaning of life? What's the meaning of the universe? And how do we as humans live here in a way that enhances this beautiful place? And so that requires some deep inner work.
Beautiful. That is the voice of Bryony Schwann, and she was just talking about starting Women's Voices for the Earth and co-founding the Biomimicry Institute. Now, Bryony, you do a lot of work with the Wild Skies Raptor Center, and you've been doing some profound work regarding climate change. So I wanted to talk to you about some of your more recent work.
Yeah, so I've had my own consulting company now for 5 or 6 years, and part of my work is helping other organizations, and some of them are nonprofit organizations. And the other half of my work is I became a certified executive coach a few years ago using integral theory. So a lot of that is, as I talked about, is the inner work. But the consulting work that I'm really passionate about, I do work with two raptor organizations, Wild Skies Raptor Center with Brooke Tanner, who is this amazing young woman who is the person in Western Montana that rescues all of the eagles and ospreys and owls, these magnificent birds who unfortunately die or are injured frequently due to human issues like getting struck by cars, electrocuted from power lines, golden eagles especially, and some bald eagles being poisoned because of lead and ammunition, and they eat carcasses that have been left in the field. And Brooke is the woman that these birds get taken to. And so I've been working with Brooke the last couple of years to help her build her organization up some more. She does amazing work. I also do work with Rob Dominic, who has RaptorView Research Institute. And Rob and Adam, who are the two lead biologists there, Rob is the founder, they've been doing incredibly important work researching the migratory path of raptors. They use telemetry, GPS telemetry, and they capture the birds when they're on their migration route. And now when they put these GPS units on them, they're just tiny little things that they can hitch. They can actually track those birds from Alaska all the way down to Mexico or Argentina or wherever, depending on the species, where they're traveling to, and be able to actually document their migratory routes. So especially it's particularly important because they like to take the winds and the thermals that are running along the spines of the, for instance, the Rocky Mountain Range. Well, that's also because that's where the wind is. That's where we're putting wind turbines and doing wind development. So it's really critical to know how human development is going to impact raptors on their migratory routes. The other project that I'm working on, which I'm really excited, is called the Soil Carbon Accrual Project, and it's a regenerative agricultural project. And I'm working with Chico State University and Carbon Underground, which is another nonprofit organization. And you know, what is regenerative agriculture? Regenerative agriculture is, it's the biomimicry of agriculture. It's doing agriculture the way nature would do agriculture. And this is the thing that I believe that will get us out of this evolutionary knothole that we're in around climate change. Because we all know that we need to get off fossil fuels. But even if we get off all fossil fuel tomorrow, which we know won't happen because we're addicted to it as human beings, and it's politically very difficult. And there are lots of amazing organizations that are working on trying to move us to renewable energy. The reality is that we have a legacy of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere from decades of dumping carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. And if we have to have any hope of survival, we have got to get that carbon down and back into the soil. Because nature has already done this. About 400 million years ago, we had much higher levels of carbon in the atmosphere. And it was the early plants and fungi and mosses and stuff that actually pulled that carbon out of the atmosphere and created this atmosphere that we have now that sustains life. So nature's already shown that it can be done. What we need to do is actually help her to do it. And so we have to change our agricultural practices from industrial agriculture, where we put pesticides and fertilizers in the soil and we destroy the soil. We destroy it by tilling it. There are now farmers that are showing that if you do no-till with cover crops in the winter, and regenerative agriculture is very specific, how you do it depends on the ecosystem that you're in. So it's a fairly complex science. But there are farmers now showing very high levels of carbon accrual in the soil. We have calculated that if we could convert just 25% of the agricultural lands that are currently under cultivation into regenerative agriculture, we can pull down our entire legacy of carbon. And so the Soil Carbon Accrual Project is a 3 to 5 year demonstration project and study. We don't really need to know that we can do it. We know we can do it, but we want to show definitive data to be able to show that to governments around the world that this is the solution. And it's a great thing because not only does it pull down carbon, it creates soil that holds water better. So we have less flooding. We have less loss of evaporation of water. We get much more rich nutrient-rich plants. So a much better food source, crops that are much more nutrient-rich than from industrial agriculture. We protect biodiversity. So there are all these added benefits besides just the fact that we're pulling carbon out of the atmosphere. Mm-hmm. And so I think this is a definitive project and study that is going to be a game changer for us.
It was while we were living internationally, about 11 years ago, that Explorer Maps first started, when Chris and his brother Greg decided to join forces and bring the maps to the whole wide world. Hi, this is Vanessa, Chris's wife. Each map is a labor of love, and I am lucky enough to see them all grow step by step from the early research and planning stages onto a large white piece of paper, through penciling, inking, and finally seeing the real magic happen as Chris adds the colour. As each one reaches the end phase, I get to examine them closely in the hope that I spot any unfinished bits before Chris sends them off. But there's always new illustrations to see every time. I love going to the Missoula warehouse when we're in Montana to see each unique map on the incredible range of products that Explorer Maps now has. Having lived away from home and families for the past 17 years, our aim of connecting people and place is very poignant to me. And for that reason, my favorite maps are Flathead and the Maasai Mara, because these two places are central to our extended family gatherings and where we have made the best of memories. Which map will you get to help you treasure your own special times? Please be sure to use the promo code Mandela for a discount when you visit exploremaps.com.
This evening, we are recording The Trail Less Traveled here in Missoula. I'm in the home of Bryony Schwan. She was born in Zimbabwe, moved to Montana in 1986, has been running Whitewater since the late 80s. She founded Women's Voices for the Earth and co-founded the Biomimicry Institute. Bryony is a lifetime social change activist. I just want to say thank you for your time and energy joining me here today on The Trail Less Traveled.
Thank you, Mandela.
Let's end your show with three bits of advice.
When I think about life, which I think about a lot, and I think about, as I mentioned earlier, the meaning of life and our purpose here, I did a lot of work a while back. I did a course at UC Berkeley called The Science of Happiness. Mm-hmm. And I think one of the most important things is we have gotten caught up in this capitalist system that makes us think that material things are going to make us happy. Mm-hmm. That if we just have the right house, the right car, the right clothes, we'll be happy. But the science shows that that's really not true. That true happiness comes from our relationships with other people in our communities. And the other critical thing about it is having a sense of purpose. People always talk about find your passion. Yes, you should find your passion, but you also need a sense of purpose. You need a reason to get out of bed in the morning. And everybody's purpose and passion is different. And just because somebody else does, you know, is a great actor or a politician or whatever, that doesn't have to be your thing, but find your thing and do it. And my motto is also work hard, but play hard too. You got to find balance, and you can't do the right work in the world unless you have time for play. Play is incredibly important, and that's why I like to run rivers, and I'm a crazy photographer. I love to be out in nature with my camera. The other thing I'd say is do the inner work. You know, we all understand the concept of the fact that we need to remain physically fit in our lives. We need to take care of our bodies by hiking, going to the gym, playing racquetball, whatever. We understand that concept. We know that you can't go to the gym once or for 1 week or 1 month, and then that's going to carry you through your life. But we don't think about our inner life and understanding that mental fitness, being a healthy human being internally, also requires a lifetime of work. And we think that it's just a part of our lives that we really, really ignore. And the reality is we all come to this life a little bit damaged because we come from imperfect families. Some people's families are more imperfect than others. Some people have had to deal with, you know, parents who've been addicted to drugs or alcohol, or they've come from a life of poverty and hardship. We all come with familial challenges and cultural challenges. And we also come from evolutionary challenges. We are hardwired to react out of fear. And it takes work. You know, you think about road rage. To not respond from a place of fear and to be able to pause and to take a moment and respond from love, respond from our prefrontal cortex. Mm-hmm. That is a lifetime's practice. And it takes work to look inside at who we really are and how we show up in the world. And so I just encourage people to do that work. It's not about whether there's something wrong with you. It's work that all of us, there's not a human being on this planet that doesn't need to do that work. And I guess my final thing is be kind. We're all struggling through this. We all have ups and downs. Life is not easy. Our lives might look great to other people on the outside, but everybody's struggling with who they are. You know, are they going to make it in the world? Are they going to be able to keep a roof over their head? Are they going to be able to protect their children, love their animals, whatever it is? We're all on a path, and let's be kind to each other. And most important, let's get outside and enjoy this beautiful planet.
Namaste, Missoula. Mandela here, your host of The Trail Less Traveled, the Trail 103.3's locally harvested adventure radio series. The show premieres every Sunday evening from 6 to 7 Mountain Time, and you can stream live online at trail1033.com. If you missed the premiere, the show is also a podcast available everywhere. The Trail Less Traveled is dedicated to documenting humanity and collecting stories and sounds from some of the most remote locations around the world. Most of the time, I record these shows in that person's natural habitat. The show was produced at the Missoula Broadcasting Company, nestled in the mountains of Missoula, Montana. What a beautiful place to be. My adventure tip this week is in relation to international currency. I just want to give you a friendly reminder that it is wise to have a plan for your currency before you arrive in your destination country. For example, countries like Zimbabwe, it's not easy to find an ATM. So make sure you have a plan, whether it's travel checks or carrying cash, before you leave the States. I would like to end the show by extending gratitude to a small family business based in Missoula, Montana, who recently partnered with the Trail Less Traveled in order to connect people and place. That small family business is Missoula's very own Explorer Maps. Explorer Maps has over 60 hand-drawn story maps. They donate a percentage of everything sold back to the conservation of these public lands. Be sure to pencil in our next Cartography Comes Alive event with the Clark Fork Coalition on April 17th. That's it for this week's adventure, my friends in Missoula and around the world. But until next week, please remember, conservation isn't a spectator sport. Get informed, get engaged, and speak up on behalf of wildlife and wild places.